and welcome to New Books in Sports. I'm your host, Bruce Berglund. Each week, we choose an interesting new book on some area of sports, and we interview the author. This week, my guest is journalist Teddy Jameson, and we are discussing his memoir, Whose Side Are You On? Sport, the Troubles, and Me, published by Yellow Jersey Press in September 2011. In the three decades of the Troubles in Northern Ireland, from 1969 to the Good Friday Agreement of 1998, some 3,500 people were killed in the sectarian violence, more than half of these civilians. Daily life in the province was punctuated by checkpoints, roadblocks, and a constant military presence. Yet, amidst the bomb attacks and shootings and security sweeps and chronic unemployment, there was something like normal life in Northern Ireland. People did find work, children went to school, and there were games and sports. In fact, as Teddy Jameson explains in his book and our interview, sports were an important part of life during the Troubles. For some, they were a needed outlet from the tensions and violence, while for others, sports were a way to emphasize the divisions between Catholic and Protestant, Republican and Loyalist. We learn that there were players who were targeted because of which side they were on, while there were a few athletes, just a few, who rose above the sectarian divide and gained the support of all Northern Irish. I learned a lot from reading Teddy's book and talking with him about it. But what I gained from him was not just a new understanding of life and sports in Northern Ireland of the 70s and 80s. Teddy's discovery of his own irrepressible allegiance to Northern Irish sports, something that has continued in the decades since he left the province, will be familiar to anyone who has moved away from their homeland yet still feels a spontaneous spark of connection while watching the old home team take the field. The loyalties and emotional attachments of sports fans run deep, and as I learned from Teddy's book, our migrations tend to strengthen these attachments rather than diminish them. I enjoyed my visit with Teddy, and I think you'll appreciate our interview. On the line today from Glasgow, my guest is Teddy Jameson. Teddy, thank you for joining me on New Books in Sports.
It's a pleasure.
So we typically begin these interviews by asking the author to give an introduction and explain his background, but since your book is a memoir, most of the program is going to be devoted to discussing your background. So instead, I'll ask you to say a few words about the work you're doing now as a writer and what led you to write this book.
Well, I'm a journalist. That's my day job. I write for a newspaper in Glasgow called The Herald. It used to be The Glasgow Herald, now The Herald. And I tend to be a features writer, magazine writer. I'll do reportage, celebrity interviews, across the board, really.
And then what led you to write the book?
Well,
because this is your first book, correct?
It is my first book, yes, rather late in life, I suppose, in my late 40s. The book started, the short story or the long story, is it started with an obituary, in fact. 3 years ago, I read in a London newspaper an obituary of a motorbike rider called Robert Dunlop. Robert Dunlop was killed in a road race in Northern Ireland, in a practice session, in fact, before the race. Two things kind of attracted my attention. Firstly, the name Dunlop's a very famous one in Northern Ireland. Robert was a successful motorbike rider. His sons, in fact, Michael and William, are both compete. And his brother Joey is one of the kind of most famous Northern Irish sporting figures. Perhaps not so well known outside the North, but in the North, a huge figure. He was 5 times world champion, in fact, in motorcycling, and a big figure in the 80s and 90s. And so I was aware of the name, and the race in which he was killed, or the practice session in which he was killed, the Northwest 200, actually takes place in the town in which I grew up, Coleraine, in the north coast of Northern Ireland. And basically they close for a weekend, they close off the roads, and these motorbikes careen round it, getting up to 150, 160 miles an hour. And tragically, he was killed during a practice session. So I was reading his obituary, and right at the end, there was a little mention of his brother Joey. And Joey, unfortunately and tragically for the family, also was killed in a road race. He was killed in Estonia in the year 2000. And the obituary mentioned that when his body was brought back, it was brought back to Dublin, and then was going to be driven north for his burial. Now, unfortunately, it was in July in 2000, and that's the marching season in the north, and it just so happened to coincide with the Drumcree disturbances. Drumcree is a place near Portadown. The Orange Order at the time wanted to march down a particular street, which was the traditional route. Unfortunately, the local inhabitants of that street, the Garvaki Road it's called, went from the nationalist community, and understandably weren't very keen on them marching down there. The march was banned, but the Orange Order kind of basically camped out, and lots of sympathisers came and joined them, and it was a huge disturbance across the country. The police were involved, there were roadblocks set up, and at the same time, Joey Dunlop's body was being brought back to Dublin and then driven north. The problem was it couldn't get to the north, so many roadblocks and so much disturbances, that Robert had to actually make a plea to say, can you let my brother's body come home? And it just struck me that here was a sporting story, a very small one, but one that just showed you how sport and politics mix. How just by coincidence, or just a coincidence of time or geography, the sport and the politics of police come together. And I just thought, well, over the last 40 years, during the Troubles from the late 60s to 98, when the Good Friday Agreement was signed, and beyond, and since then, I'm sure there are many Troubles like that. Or rather, many stories like that. So that just seemed, it's a little light bulb went off in my head. The longer version is obviously my own story as well, because I left Northern Ireland. I grew up in there, born in 63. I was six when the Troubles started. And so I grew up to the 70s and 80s in the province. I left in the early 80s to go to university. I was very keen to go. I just found nothing there that appealed to me. I wanted to leave. But one of the things that kept me connected other than family was sport. My love of Northern Ireland as a football team, a soccer team, certain sporting individuals in the 80s, Barry McGuigan the boxer, Dennis Taylor, Alex Higgins, both snooker players, things like that. So sport had always been where I felt most Northern Irish, I guess. And I just thought there was something to explore in both of those strands, really. How sport and politics mixed for the sportsmen and women in the province, and how sport and politics mixed for me.
So let's go back to Northern Ireland, and I'll ask you to set the scene of your growing up here. Sure. So where did you come from? What did your family do? And I guess we should find out at the start, which side were you on in the sectarian division?
Sure. I grew up in a town called Coleraine, as I mentioned, a predominantly Protestant town, as I was. My dad had been in the army. I was actually born in Germany in a British military hospital in 1963. And then when he left the army, we moved back to Northern Ireland. Coleraine is, as I say, in the north coast. At that time, it would have been a small town, 15,000, 20,000 people, I guess. But I think one of the things that I try to get across in the book is that Northern Ireland isn't quite the same place as you would maybe think of it through the news reports from that time. That vision of Northern Ireland, which is the barricades, the bombs, the riots, all of that's true. But quite often it was limited to quite small geographical areas. So the town I grew up in was mostly peaceful through all that time, mostly peaceful. There were a couple of bombings, 1973 and in the early 90s. The 73 bombings, I think six people were killed. 1990s just caused a lot of damage. But for the most part, it was, you know, relatively peaceful place. And it also wasn't as divided as Belfast would be. In Belfast, you'd have the Shanco and the Falls. One was Protestant, one was Catholic, and clearly marked. Clearly marked their allegiances. In Coleraine, it was slightly more different than that. Yes, the red, white, and blue of the Union Jack was very much in evidence. At the same time, though, my best friends as a kid were Catholics. Bernard and Michael Hunt, their father was overworking in Northern Ireland. He's from Yorkshire. He had a very strong Yorkshire accent, I still remember. My Northern Ireland was slightly different than the one if you'd grown up in the Shankill Falls. My that was a different story to mine. So my dad was a bricklayer by profession. During the 70s, he was a member of the Territorial Army, which is a kind of volunteer kind of reserve force for the British Army. And then in the early 80s, he joined the Ulster Defence Regiment. The Ulster Defence Regiment were a part-time organisation set up to support the British Army and the local police force, the Royal Ulster Constabulary at the time. Just during those years in the 70s and 80s when the troubles were at their peak, really. So he would go out maybe 2-3 times a week. He would go on patrol, going out, setting up roadblocks, stopping cars, things like that. And he'd return early hours of the morning. And quite often as a teenager, I remember kind of waiting to hear him come back. Just to be sure he was fine, I guess. Mm-hmm. And obviously, as I got older, as a teenager, I kind of was aware that being in the UDR was something that could make you a target. And every morning I'd get up in the morning and see my dad out at his car looking underneath just to make sure there was no bombs being planted in the night. So it's difficult to kind of get across the fact that on one hand, my experience was very different than an experience that a kid in Belfast would have. But there were similarities, and there were still sectarianism was abroad throughout Northern Ireland, and it still is, I'm afraid. So that was kind of my background, and I grew up at the same time. I grew up not really aware of the troubles until I was well into my teens, I think.
So let's bring sports into the picture, to start, I should ask you to give something of an overview, and you did a bit already in talking about Union Jacks flying in your town, to give something of an overview of the issues and the sides involved in the troubles for those who are less familiar with the history of Northern Ireland. And to do this, I want to pick up on a line in your book, and you write, I'll quote it, "As always with sports in Ireland, both North and South, it's all about the symbols. It's about which flags are flying and what songs are being sung. And who is singing them." So could you give us something, jumping off from that quote, something of an introduction to these symbols that the different sides used at, say, a football match and what they meant?
Sure. I think the easy thing to say, or the easiest thing to say, is that football, any sport, could be a kind of theatre for the politics of the place. It's as simple as that. Football's a good place to start, because in a Northern Irish level, teams were either Catholic or Protestant. A football ground would be in a particular part of the country, in a particular part of the city, that would usually be predominantly either Protestant or Catholic, and therefore inevitably would have a Protestant or Catholic support. Now, therefore, when a Catholic side met a Protestant side, sparks would fly, songs would be sung, and sometimes punches would be thrown, things like that. Riots were known, particularly in the 70s. Football and other sports as well provided a kind of amphitheatre for the kind of wider sectarian energies that were going on in the North at that time. Famously, in Northern Ireland, Linfield, which is a team in Belfast, prided themselves on not having any Catholic players. For years and years, well into the 1980s, that was the case. 1990s, I think. Sport became therefore a chance for fans to kind of basically show their allegiances through the flags they flew and through the songs they sang. If you were a Protestant, you'd be singing The Sash, which is a song about the Battle of the Boyne in 1690, and you know. Catholic clubs, there's Cliftonville in Belfast, for example, very famously, would be singing songs about what was going on in terms of the troubles. There's a very famous and infamous chant that the Cliftonville fans sang after the death of a Conservative MP in Britain, in which they kind of lauded his death, effectively. So sport became, for some, a way of actually expressing their kind of position, as it were. Now, that's really on a local level, on a bigger level. if you play for Northern Ireland, in a sense, that's a political statement straight away. Northern Ireland is also a contentious issue. There's a division in the north between a Protestant unionist community who are very keen on the idea of Northern Ireland being part of Britain, and a nationalist Catholic community who many of whom would rather be part of an all Ireland, a bigger Ireland, a 32 county Ireland. So Catholics did play for Northern Ireland's football team. Increasingly, though, certainly in the 90s, that became a contentious issue. So yeah, that's kind of where we are. But the flags you fly and the symbols that you kind of stand under, as it were, could mark you out. So for example, if I'm trying to think of an example, someone like Wayne McCulloch, who's a boxer in the 1990s world champion at one point, as a teenager, he came from the Shankill in Belfast, the Protestant Shankill. And yet he, because of the way boxing's arranged in Ireland, it's an all-Irish, all-Ireland sport. Some sports are, some sports aren't, kind of legacy of partition in the early 20s. He ended up representing Ireland in the Olympics as a 17-year-old and was asked, in fact, to carry the Irish flag. Now, that's an incredibly contentious thing for a young man from the heartland of, you know, Protestant Belfast. You have to carry an Irish flag, a tricolour. And it caused him some problems, I think, afterwards, although he kind of plays that down a little, to be honest. So sport was a way in which, inevitably, all these politics that were flying around at that time, they became absorbed and became, in a way, sport was a way of expressing them as well, if that explains it.
So one figure that you talk about right at the start of the book who transcended these divisions was George Best. And as you say, it's nearly impossible to write anything new about George Best, but you take a stab at it by looking at him through the prism of his Northern Irishness. So what is the picture we get of Best when looking at him in this context?
Well, Best is as you say, he's probably the most famous sportsman from the north of Ireland. He's still a hugely revered figure in the whole of Britain and across Europe. Although he never went to a World Cup, he's still one of the most familiar sporting football faces, I think. And he had the advantage of actually becoming a star in the 60s before the Troubles really took off. So in a sense, his familiarity, his success was already established by 1969 when the Troubles really began. He'd went to Manchester in England and been a hugely successful figure, and in a way kind of embodied the 60s in a way. He was the first kind of pop star footballer in British terms. So he was already very well known and very well loved for that reason. So even though he came from a Protestant background in the heart of East Belfast, his father was an Orangeman. He came from a very typical Northern Irish background. He had already transcended his background by the time the Troubles started. Now, that's not to say that the Troubles didn't catch up with him now and again. In 1971, for example, he was sent a death threat before a game that he was playing on Saturday against Newcastle United, and you know, that's the kind of thing that you have to take seriously, I think. The tragedy is that far too many Northern Irish sportsmen and women were sent death threats in those years. But Best played the game, scored a goal in that game, and in the end decided that he comes out and says, well, it wasn't really a serious threat. It was just someone wanting to kind of make some political leeway, I guess, make some political headway, can't think of the word. Just someone who wanted to kind of make a name or make a headline, I guess. But the fact is that there were kids in West Belfast and in kind of Catholic Belfast who were just as excited by Best as kids in East Belfast. You know, Manchester United also has a kind of unique position in the north in that it's supported by children and people from both sides of the divide. You know, whether you're orange or green, you could still be a red. Mm-hmm. I think. And so Best was in a kind of different position than many who would follow after, because he was a radio star. He was already hugely successful, the most famous Northern Irish person, I would say, at that time in the 60s. And he also represented, as I say, a kind of pop star vision of the North, which is not something we had very much over that time. So he kind of represented something different, and it was enough to make him kind of transcend what was going on at home. Not totally, as I say, there was a death threat. There was, his sister was shot outside a nightclub one time, mm-hmm. Because of her background, because she was a Protestant and identified as such. And there were erroneous support reports that Best actually contributed to the Reverend Ian Paisley's political party at one point, mm-hmm. in the early 70s. So, you know, he wasn't totally above what was happening in the province. But at the same time, he lived in England. He was a star in England. Mm-hmm. And the sheer magnetism of the man, the sheer charisma, his abilities, everyone was enthralled by that. Mm-hmm. There's no question he's the great Northern Irish sports figure. You know, there'll be others since who've been world champions in various things, but Best kind of stands apart. Simply because of his talent, because of his ability and his genius, and all of these things meant that he was looked up to from both communities. And it was very significant when he died in 2005 that when his funeral ceremony, which took place in Stormont, which is the kind of home of Northern Irish politics, really, the Parliament there, representatives of all sides came to that funeral, including former IRA men, former UVF and UDA men. It was kind of non-denominational, I guess, is mm-hmm. the way to say it. Yeah.
So you noted, as you said, that during Best's career, both Catholic and Protestant kids followed Manchester United. You say, though, in your own case, your team was and still is Tottenham Spurs.
And Tottenham Hotspur.
Yeah, and you mentioned a few other clubs that your friends supported, and all of them were in the English League. And
that's
right. I was wondering, as I read this, did the rivalry of Celtic and Rangers, which has the Catholic Protestant division at its foundation, was it exported at all to Northern Ireland?
It's an interesting one, that. There's no question that Celtic and Rangers draw on big supports in Northern Ireland. But I have to say, growing up, I didn't know any Celtic or Rangers fans. Hmm. I think I knew one Celtic fan. I remember a teacher went around the class and asked us all who we supported, and one boy said Celtic. This was about the early 70s, mid-70s. The rest of us, most people supported Manchester United, most others supported Liverpool, the other big successful team in the 70s. Some of us supported Leeds. I supported Spurs, along with a couple of others, because of my uncle and because of a friend of mine who kind of indoctrinated me, I suppose, in Tottenham Hotspur. But Celtic and Rangers didn't really register, and it's a very simple reason for that, because when we were growing up, we didn't get Scottish football on the television.
Okay.
So we would grow up watching English football. It was what was there every Saturday night. Celtic and Rangers occupy, though, this kind of unique position in British football. I mean, if you go back to the 19th century, football clubs were set up by social institutions, often by churches and things like that. So quite often they would have maybe a Catholic or a Protestant background. But increasingly now, it would be very difficult for you to go to an English city and be able to say which club was Catholic, which club was Protestant. I mean, you might if you were kind of really interested in these things, but you know, I don't think too many people would know that Liverpool, for example, was set up by the Orange Order. Mm-hmm. That's in Glasgow, where I am, that's still very much evident. One, Celtic is a club with a strong Irish tradition and an Irish Catholic tradition. Rangers has a strong Unionist Protestant tradition. And they did attract supporters from the north, tends to be from Belfast, it has to be said, and from the council seats where sectarianism was really at its most bitter, where the Falls and Shankill kind of actually if you look at a map of Belfast, that the Falls and Shankill are very close, which is surprising, I think, for people from outside. They kind of run along parallel to each other. And yet these are two of the most familiar names in the kind of Troubles geography, I guess. So Celtic and Rangers had some following there, but the rest of the country, no, not really. I have to say that. I don't think that was the case. Mm-hmm. And interestingly, I think when I was a kid, no one wore football shirts because no one could afford football shirts, and it wasn't really a commercial operation at that point. But certainly, since the Good Friday Agreement, you go home, or I go home now, you would see a lot more Celtic and Rangers shirts out there because they're marks of identity. Mm-hmm. They mark you out. If you're wearing a Celtic shirt, you're obviously from the nationalist community. If you're wearing a Rangers shirt, you're from the Unionist Protestant community. They've become symbols in a way that they weren't when I was a kid, I think.
Mm-hmm. Do they say, would they have the same provocative effect today as they would have, you know, if a kid was wearing a Celtic or Rangers shirt back in your day, it would have been a clear statement. Is it read the same way today?
So. I think, oh yes, definitely.
Okay.
More so, I would argue, because as I say, when I was a kid, no one really wore football shirts. But now they're marketed and everyone wears them, and you will go over and you will see Liverpool shirts, Manchester United shirts. I'm sure you'll see a few American baseball and basketball shirts as well. But Rangers and Celtic shirts, that they come with a message. Mm-hmm. They come and they're saying, you know, this is where I am and this is who I'm from.
So one athlete whose career corresponded with the worst period of the Troubles in the early 70s. And who actually received threats was Mary Peters, who won the pentathlon at the 1972 Olympics. So could you tell us about her career and her experiences in Northern Ireland?
Yes, Mary Peters is growing up, I suppose, as a kid, the two most familiar voices other than my parents in the media would have been George Best and Mary Peters, because they were these huge figures in Northern Ireland in the 70s, the two most successful sporting figures. One, you know, one of the most glamorous footballers on the planet. The other, an Olympic gold medalist. I mean, how much higher can you get as an accolade in sport? And bizarrely, Mary is actually not Northern Irish, although she doesn't like to say that. She's from mm-hmm. Liverpool in England originally, but she moved over when she was quite young. And she's always said that she fell in love with the place, that she loved Northern Ireland, loved the people, and felt very at home there. So even when her father, or I think her mother died quite when she was quite young, and her father moved away when she was still only a teenager, she decided to stay. And she was a pentathlete. She kind of did a lot of athletic training. Was a kind of okay athlete without ever being a great athlete in the 60s. She represented Britain in the Olympics and things like that, but you know, she never really kind of imposed herself. She was happy just to go along for the ride. And it was only when she met a weightlifter called Buster McShane, who became her trainer, that suddenly she became aware of, actually, I am quite good at this. I am actually, you know, I could achieve much more than I have. And so in the early 70s, she became the athlete she was meant to be. And then culminating in 72 with winning a gold medal. Now, that was in the Munich Olympics, tragically, just the day before the Israeli athletes were killed by Palestinians, even, if I can say that. So her gold medal already had that kind of shadow over it. The real tragedy is that the day after she won the gold medal, the day after her greatest achievement in sport, the BBC, I think, in Belfast received a phone call in which a rather, they received a threat against her life, basically saying that if she returned to Northern Ireland, she might be attacked. So her greatest moment was suddenly tarnished by what must have been a terrible moment in her life. However seriously you take these things, and I don't think you can take them lightly, a threat is a threat. So she returned to Belfast, with detectives on the plane alongside her, and she was very keen to go and show off her gold medal to people of Belfast. She wasn't even allowed to kind of, they'd lined the streets with pictures of her so that she could go along and just message of celebration. they wouldn't, the detectives decided that that was too dangerous. They took her kind of circuitous route because they were worried about what might happen. But in the end, she did get to the centre of Belfast and just got on a bus and went through all the people. There was thousands upon thousands of people gathered just to kind of celebrate and that. So Mary Peter's story then is one that in a very crude way, the heights of sport and the depressing lows are linked inextricably within, 24 hours. She received a death threat of having won a gold medal. So in an emblematic way, she is one of these cases where sport gets overtaken by the politics. And the problem was that she was British. She had represented Britain. She was there with a Union Jack on her back. And for some, that was reason to hate her.
So I want to ask you something specific from your interview with Peters. And she talks about, you have this in the text, she talks about knowing people who were injured and killed in the decades of violence, and yet how people, including her, got on with their lives. And then, as you write, she reached out to you and touched your wrist and said, "You ran away, I stayed." Now this is Dame Mary who said this, who's a sports legend in the UK.
That's right, yeah.
How did that hit you?
Well, it's true. It's true. I mean, when I was 19, I left Northern Ireland to go to university, and I was very keen to go. It was the year after the hunger strikes, which was kind of one of the biggest events and troubles. As I explained already, my father was going out on patrol two or three times a week, and I'd had enough of the place. I was very keen to go. Mm-hmm. So when she says that, I mean, the fact is, it's true. I did run away. And, I've gone back plenty of time. I've still got family in the north. But my life became settled in Scotland. I moved to Scotland. I never really moved away. My idea at that time was to, go to America, go to London, some of that. I didn't get anywhere near those places. But I didn't live in the north anymore. And in that sense, you could argue that I did run away. That's part of it. There's lots of Northern Irish Protestants who would cross to the mainland, as we call it, to go to university. We never go back. It's quite a common theme in many of our experiences. Others stayed. Mary Peters, is a perfect example of someone who lived through the worst of the troubles in Belfast in the 70s, when it was, I can't imagine what kind of a city it must have been to live in at that time, when there were bombs going off at regular events in the early 70s. It was quite shocking time, really, in terms of disturbances and riots and mostly bombs. That's the terrible thing. The city was blown to bits on a regular basis. But she stayed, and she was very keen to stay and very keen to be seen, to say, well, I represent what the goodness of this place is. She, as I said, she fell in love with the place, and she always said that that's what I stand for.
So did you reflect on that as you were researching and writing the book, that in the sense that even though you're from Northern Ireland, you've become an outsider? Did you feel yourself an outsider or someone with the perspective of someone who's from Northern Ireland?
Well, that has changed over the years, Bruce. I think that's the simple fact of it. When I left, as I say, I was very keen to go, and I kind of tried very hard to reinvent myself as Scottish. Mm-hmm. I think I did. I mean, I it's easy to say now, but I think I liked the idea a lot. I liked the idea of not being an Ulster Protestant, of not being from that part of the world in which, the troubles were still carrying on. I very much liked the idea that stuff didn't matter to me. I didn't place myself in the politics of Northern Ireland. I couldn't find a place in the politics of Northern Ireland. I didn't like any of it. It was all poisonous as far as I was concerned. So Scotland represented something I could be different, or some place I could be different. And I liked the idea of being Scottish. But as time went by, something would happen in sport,
a
good example. And I'd suddenly be reminded that, oh, no, actually, I'm not Scottish. I am Northern Irish. And so I took it. I left at a bad time, really, for me trying to reinvent myself, because the early 80s and mid 80s was a fantastic, successful time for sport in Northern Ireland. We had a very successful football team that went to two World Cups, which is unheard of now. We had a number of world champions. I mentioned Joey Dunlop a little earlier. He was world champion, I think, three or four times in a row. We had Barry McGuigan, perhaps the most famous boxer. Not strictly from the north, actually. He grew up just slightly over the border. But we adopted him, and we said he was one of us anyway. So every time someone like McGuigan would box, or Northern Ireland played in a football game, or Alex Higgins or Dennis Taylor, the snooker players, played, I would be reminded that, no, actually, do you know what? I am Northern Irish. I can't pretend that I'm not, because I care more about this than I do care about Scotland playing football or a Scottish player winning, you know, a Scottish boxer, whatever. That was always a reminder of who I was and where I was from. So sport, unfortunately, was a tie I couldn't cut, as it were. It just reminded me of my origins.
Yeah, yeah. And that's something I find fascinating in the book, and I find it gives it something of a more... it's not simply a book about Northern Ireland. It's about the experience of being a sports fan in a general sense. And I've experienced this as someone who's migrated within the States. My home state is Minnesota. And I can't undo that basic allegiance. And you describe a scene in your book, and I forget what event it was, but you're watching this event and you're alone, and it was watching Northern Ireland, and this was your sense, as you say, I was trying to be Scottish, but then I realized in watching Northern Irish sport, I wasn't. There was still this attachment.
Very much so, very much so. You know, I realized after a few years in Scotland that much as I liked the place, I wasn't Scottish. Mm-hmm. That I'd grown up in a different culture, and that much as I liked the new culture I was in, it wasn't the same. Mm-hmm. And there were certain touch points, reference points that were different. And after a while, I decided, well, no, I'm not going to be Scottish. I'm still Northern Irish, just for some reason. And sport was always, as I say, sport was always the kind of connecting bit where the vehicle for reminding me of who I was and where I came from. Now, that was sometimes problematic, you know. In the 90s, for example, as recently as 2002, a Celtic player called Neil Lennon received a death threat because he was selected to captain the Northern Ireland football team. Now, that was problematic for me because did I want to be associated with a team that obviously was a target for sectarianism, that players could be singled out and said, well, you're a Catholic and you're a Celtic player, therefore we don't want you to play for us or represent us. Well, I was quite happy that Neil Lennon represented Northern Ireland. He's one of the few players we had at the time who was anyway decent. But, you know, when you have that situation, when you have a player who's been, you know, singled out and actually the victim of a death threat, do you want to be associated with that team? So that was, you know, there were times when that was hugely problematic for me. You know, it kind of asks you a question about why are you a fan? What are you supporting? Yeah. And sometimes the answers I came up with weren't particularly attractive. You know, and it's really at that level of where sport and national identity kind of merge that. Was obviously problematic in Northern Ireland because of the politics of the place, and problematic for me because, you know, did I want to be associated with a team that were kind of harassing players because of the religion? Well, I certainly didn't, and yet at the same time, I still kept supporting them. I kept tuning in. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's go back to your story growing up in the time in the Troubles and. Your family did have direct contact with the violence of the Troubles, and you discuss in the chapter on that episode that touched your family how it came at the same time in the same day as the Northern Irish national team was having one of its greatest victories in probably its history against Spain in the 1982 World Cup. And you make some quite interesting remarks in that chapter about how these two memories, the memory of the football match and the memory of the violence that hit your family, how these two memories play in your head. So can you talk about that, please?
Yes, indeed. Northern Ireland went to the World Cup in 1982, not expecting to do very much, but actually got through the group, beating Spain, the hosts, on the way, which is an incredible event and certainly unexpected, I think. And I do remember very strongly, or very vivid memories, I think they're memories, could be kind of me kind of conjuring these things up from the past and wanting to believe their memories. But I have very vivid memories of sitting in my house watching the game that night. It was June 25th, 1982, when Northern Ireland scored a goal. So it was 1-0 victory they won. And I'm sure I jumped off my seat, and I'm sure I heard voices, you know, in each house up the street. There was a council estate, and, you know, I can almost hear like a wave of noise kind of rising and falling, just in tune with my own. It was thrilling, just a thrilling evening, that moment when sport just gives you everything you want. The strange thing is, as I say, it's a memory, and yet a couple of years ago when I was reading a little kind of privately published history of my father's Ulster Defence Regiment, I realised my dad couldn't have been there that night. He must have been out on patrol, because that was the night my dad got blown up. This would have happened in the early hours of the morning, maybe 3 or 4 hours after I'd been jumping off my seat. His Land Rover, his patrol was out, and a road bomb had been planted and blown up, leaving a huge crater in the road. But thankfully, he was fine. I first was aware of this the next morning when he kind of limped around the house. He obviously was not in some pain. But he'd been trying to kind of hide this from my mother and things like this. And the curious thing, as I say, as you kind of alluded to there, was that these two memories had kind of fractured in my head. It required, you know, this book to tell me actually this happened at the same time, because these, as you can understand, were huge, huge memories for me. The sweetest kind of sporting memory I have, perhaps. And the other, this kind of hugely traumatic event, because this was in many ways the kind of culmination of all my fears, all those mornings getting up and looking out to see my father, looking under the car and, you know, watching him turn the key in the ignition, and that sudden kind of shiver, oh, is anything going to happen? Is everything okay? This was the culmination of this was the time in which something did happen. So for whatever reason in my head, I separated those two things. I still can't quite work out why. I mean, the obvious thing is perhaps that I just didn't want them one to sully the other. Mm-hmm. I didn't want one of my greatest memories to kind of be impacted by a particularly terrible one. And it's still kind of, I'm still not really sure how I did that and how I managed to kind of somehow separate these two things that came together so closely. But I did, and the reason I think is very simple, that I was so thrilled by that sporting success. As I say, I didn't want it to be kind of undermined by the trauma that followed it, I guess. Mm-hmm. So, that's where we are. My father was okay. He was hurt. He was injured, but thankfully, it was no more than that. It was nothing terribly serious. Goodness knows, there's so many stories in Northern Ireland during those 30, 40 years in which people, you know, went out and didn't come back. That you know, I can be very grateful for that. So, as you say, these two things happened so tightly together, but for the most part of 20, 30 years, I managed to separate them in my head quite successfully. And it was a bit of a shock, actually, when I realised I read this book and that day rings a bell. Why does that day ring a bell? And then I was like, oh my goodness, that happened on the same night in which I was cheering on my country in football, and the same night when I thought my dad was there cheering on with me, but he clearly wasn't. He was already in control.
Yeah, I found that fascinating. And here again, this is something that I think that can speak to the universal experience of being a sports fan. And it prompted me to think, where is the place in my memory for recollections of sports and recollections of family? And I have to admit, after thinking about it, after reading that passage in your book, that the memories from my life as a sports fan come to the fore more often than memories of my childhood or experiences as a father. For instance, the memories of the two difficult births of two of my children are really sealed away in my memory, whereas the memories, both good and bad, of being a sports fan. For instance, watching the football team I follow lose in the playoffs, this memory, it comes up weekly. I remember watching that game. So that was quite interesting. And I think, you know, once again, you're saying something more universal about how sports fans, you know, thinking about it, how we process that, our experiences.
Yeah, I think sport is an easy kind of memory in a way. You know, for many people, sport is, yes, you want your team to win, mm-hmm. hate it when you lose, but in the end, there's not really anything at stake.
Yeah.
Is there? I mean, you know, in the grander scheme of things, of course, there's things at stake. We all invest in our football teams or our sports teams, whatever it might be. But nothing really intrinsically is at stake. You will wake up the next morning and you'll kick the cat or whatever you might do. The day will carry on and things will be fine. These other events, though, these possibly life-changing events, it's more difficult to kind of, you know, live with them. And you're right, you may well be that we just seal them off or just go back to them when we feel strong enough to think about them. The problem with that, though, in terms of Northern Ireland is, of course, for many people, sport and politics were too linked, but were linked in the most obvious case in kind of the Gaelic sports, where people were killed simply because they were sports fans, because they supported a Gaelic football team or a hurling team, and that's a question of identity. They were identified with a particular side, and that side was the enemy, and they were therefore targets. Mm-hmm.
So let's talk about football in the 70s and 80s. And this was a rough time in Northern Ireland. And it was a rough time for football in Britain and Ireland and really throughout Europe. And you just mentioned violence of the Troubles. And I was wondering, how much were the hostilities among football supporters in Northern Ireland the product of the Troubles, as opposed to how much were they part of this larger wave of hooliganism in European football in the 70s and 80s?
Well, I think first and foremost, they were a reflection of that hooliganism. I think that was people, fans, watching it on the TV in English games where there'd be riots and things, and saying, oh, that looks fun. Let's have a bit of that. Now, where it differed was that, of course, the politics of Northern Ireland allowed an extra sectarian edge to it. So whereas in England, if Leeds were playing Manchester United and there was a riot, it was because they were Leeds and Man United fans. In Northern Ireland, if Cliftonville were playing Linfield, you know, Catholic side against the Protestant side, yes, they were rival fans, but more than that, they were Catholics and Protestants. And so therefore that rivalry was supercharged, if you like, with this kind of sectarian poison. And I don't think you could say the violence, the hooliganism was any worse than it was anywhere else in Europe, but it just had an extra nasty edge to it, I think.
So one instance where the violence of the Troubles did have a direct impact on sports actually involves horse racing. So can you talk about that episode, please?
Yeah, horse racing is one of those sports that managed to go through all the violence of those years and be reasonably untouched and reasonably unmarked by what was going on in the wider community. You'd have horse trainers in the north who would go down to meetings in the south across the border, and vice versa. There was no partly because horse racing, you're not representing a country or a community or a thing. It's about horses, it's about individual jockeys and things like that. So it was, for the most part, able to kind of transcend the kind of the politics of time and place. In one occasion, though, perhaps the most famous kind of victim, sporting victim of the Troubles, was a horse, Shergar. Shergar was this incredibly successful horse, won the Derby at a canter. And owned by the Aga Khan, and in the early 1983, that's right, in the early 80s it had been retired to stud after a glorious career, after being the great horse of that time, and it went to stud in Southern Ireland in the Republic, a little bit out of Dublin. And on one night in 1983, the horse was kidnapped. Now, who kidnapped it has never really been established, but the feeling is it was the IRA, and the feeling was that they kidnapped it to demand a ransom of the Aga Khan, just a way of making some money. Mm-hmm. to carry on the kind of activities. The horse disappeared. It's never been seen since. It just totally disappeared. We don't know what happened to it. The feeling is that it was in stud at the time, that it was probably too difficult to deal with if you weren't experienced with horses. And the suggestion is that certainly one source in the 1990s came back and said that it had been kidnapped by the IRA and the IRA had to kill it because it was just unmanageable. But Shergar, therefore, has kind of been this phantom, really, since every so often bones will be dug up in a field in Ireland, usually near the border, and saying, oh, maybe this is Shergar, maybe this is what's left. But we don't know. It's not even clear that the IRA did do it, although everyone, the suspicions are certainly there. The tragedy in many ways is that the operation that followed the horse kidnap was pretty farcical and pretty inept by the Gardaí, and the other issue was that the Aga Khan actually didn't own the horse on his own anymore. Perhaps if he'd been the only voice that the kidnappers were dealing with, perhaps an agreement could have been reached, but he was one of a syndicate by this time. The horse was owned by a syndicate, and there's a number of voices competing then, dealing with the demands that come in. And to be honest, it may well be the horse was dead already within a day or two of being kidnapped. Who knows? But Shergar is the kind of the one event in which horse racing was significantly impacted by the Troubles, or so we think, anyway.
So turning ahead to the peace process in the late 90s into the 2000s, you talk about how the peace process parallels the reemergence of football in Northern Ireland. So football went through a rough patch in the 1990s in Northern Ireland. But then in the 2000s, there was really a deliberate campaign to promote or revive football in Northern Ireland and to transcend sectarian divide.
Yes.
In football. So could you talk about that, please?
Of course, I think that's one of the good stories, one of the happy stories, or one of the great achievements in sport in the North in the last 40 years. I mentioned earlier that Neil Lennon, this player who joined Celtic and then became a target for death threats this was 2002, I believe that happened. At that point, Northern Irish football, the international side, was pretty much in the dumps. They weren't a particularly good team. No one was going to the games. Very few people were going to the games. The games were being held in a pretty decrepit stadium. So nothing was going really right for it. And then on top of this came this death threat. And on one of the most experienced players was never played again for his country. You know, he was taken out of it. So for 10 years before that, there'd been a lot increasingly sectarian supporting Northern Ireland. It culminated in a game in 1993 between the Republic and Northern Ireland, which was seen as a very vicious atmosphere that night. That may or may not be exaggerated. It may just be just football rivalry, but there certainly was a kind of sectarian age, but by many accounts. And that kind of gathered over the next decade until this moment when Neil Lennon received this death threat. So basically the image of Northern Irish football was in the toilet. I mean, it's as simple as that. It was no one supported it. The only people who supported it seemed to the outside world to be bigots. They seemed to be Protestant bigots who had a thing against Catholic. Didn't want any Catholic players playing for the team. Now, Catholic players have always played for Northern Ireland. It's, you know, in that 82 World Cup, it was kind of reasonably evenly divided between Catholic players and Protestant players. Suddenly, it was an issue what community you were from. In the past, it hadn't been because, frankly, we didn't have enough good players to make that division. Suddenly, in Lennon's case, it was an issue, and at that point, certainly in my own experience, I was just disgusted and for a bit turned off and tuned out, as it were. But other people, fans on the ground in Belfast in Northern Ireland, decided that this was the point in which they said, oh, you know what, we've had enough of this. We've had enough of this. We're going to do something about it. And a number of them, including people like Jim Rainey and Stuart McAfee, decided that they were actually going to try and effectively undermine the sectarianism that was going on. So they set up an organisation called Football for All, backed by the Irish Football Association. And they would go into the games. They would block book tickets. And when sectarian songs began to be sung, they would drown them out. They would get a megaphone and shout louder. They would sing their own songs. They made up their own songs that were, just kind of silly little ditties that, about the players or about the manager or whatever. And they kind of, it's an act of kind of bullying in a way. They kind of bullied the bigots out to be quiet, just by making more noise. That sounds a really simple thing, doesn't it? But it actually was incredibly effective. And so in 2002, Northern Ireland's image as a country was just, as I say, in the toilet. Within 4 years, the Northern Ireland fans were being presented as the best fans in Europe, in just before the World Cup. Now, that's an incredible change around. And Jim Rainey, who's one of the kind of leading figures of that, he likes to show two pictures. One is a picture of Northern Ireland fans in the 1990s and 2000s, beginning of the 2000s, all dressed up in red, white and blue with the Union Jacks and all those things that symbolise Protestant Northern Ireland. By 2006, you went to a match at Windsor Park, you'd be surrounded by a sea of green. Everyone was wearing green. Now, green was a colour that, for Protestant, the Protestant community, was a Catholic colour. It was an Irish colour. It was a nationalist colour. Suddenly, everyone was on board and wearing the green shirt of Northern Ireland. So that was an amazing, I think still really amazing, under-recognised achievement, I think. I mean, they're still doing that. They're still going out there and singing their songs and signing people up and having forums on the website and things like this. Active and kind of encouraging that kind of non-sectarian approach. Mm-hmm. It's not getting any easier for them. There's still people who would prefer to be able to sing sectarian songs. That's always going to be there. That's an ongoing fight for them. But the fact that they've managed to do it so long and so well, I think it's a huge achievement.
Yeah, I love that slogan, "We're not Brazil." I see you can get t-shirts. I want to get one of those t-shirts.
Unfortunately, we're definitely not Brazil. That's one of the great tragedies of my life. I think I would love us to be Brazil, but no, we're Northern Ireland, which is a rather different thing.
Well, let me ask you that with... So Northern Ireland, for American listeners, the population of Northern Ireland is about the same as the state of Nebraska. So a pretty small population. Yeah. And yet you had, in the 60s and 70s, one of the top footballers in the world, the pentathlon gold medal winner. You've talked about world boxing champions. You've had numerous other footballers playing for clubs in England. How is it that a population that size, and looking back in the 60s and 70s and 80s, a province torn by violence, the economy is in terrible shape, how did Northern Ireland produce these athletes?
It's a very good question. It's a very interesting question. And I'm not sure I have an answer for you. What I could say, though, is that one of the most interesting interviews I did for the book was an interview with a rugby player called Willie John McBride, a huge figure in Northern Ireland. He played for Ulster, he played for Ireland, captain Ireland, was himself tragically, targeted. He received threats. But one of the big figures in British sporting history in the 70s. And I asked him at one point, he was a bank manager in Belfast at the worst time. He was there in the early 70s when Belfast was being blown to bits on a regular basis. He tells incredible surreal images of doors, daggered through other doors that have been blown off the hinges and just sent flying. And his most amazing thing was he was running for one day from a bomb, and he said when it went up, it looked as if the whole city kind of moved. It felt like the whole city moved underneath him. And he says it couldn't have happened, but it looked as if all the windows came out of the buildings and they went back in again. Mm-hmm. So he really saw Belfast at its worst and Northern Ireland at its worst. And yet, when I asked him, well, God, in the middle of that, why are you still playing rugby? Why were you still turning out? And it just totally flummoxed me. He said, well, why not? Why would I not play the thing that I love? You know, and I think that why any country produces athletes that rise to the top of the heap is, you know, there may well be reasons for it, but just sport was one thing that carried on through all those years that allowed people to be themselves. Not all the time. Some of the time it was impossible to ignore, but some of the time you could not be a Protestant or a Catholic. You could be a sportsman. You could be a rugby player. You could be a boxer. You could be, you know, a jockey, whatever it might be. You might own a horse, whatever. You could be something that wasn't marked by the divisions of the place. And I wonder if that provided a kind of psychological bolt hole. Certainly, I think for me it did. I think that's fair to say that's how I feel about it now. Now, that doesn't really explain why all these people, all these incredible sportsmen, emerged from this called small parcel of land, and they're still emerging. I say in the book that 1985 is the greatest year for Northern Irish sport because of Barry McGuigan, because of Dennis Taylor, because of a number of things. It's possible to argue that 2011 is, in fact, mm-hmm. just as great a year. We have, in terms of, we've taken over golf, haven't we? We are the leading nation in the world. We've got Rory McIlroy winning the US Open. We've Darren Clarke winning the Open. And, of course, before Rory won the Open, we had Graeme Dahl winning the US Open as well. So we've had two US Open winners and a British Open winner within the space of 2 years. It's an incredible achievement. And I always say that Northern Ireland won the Ryder Cup last time round because Dahl and McIlroy were key to that. So it goes on and who knows what the explanation is for why that would happen. But I wonder if it may be that there's sport was an escape for a lot of people and so carried on through all those years.
So we're almost out of time. I will ask about, you mentioned Rory McIlroy, and you talk about him briefly at the end of the book, and he provides something of a close. So how does Rory McIlroy and these golfers fit into the history of sport in Northern Ireland?
Well, I would like to think, and maybe this is way too early to say this, but I would love to think that Rory McIlroy is perhaps the first post-Troubles sportsman. And that would be the ideal, wouldn't it? That we've moved to a situation where sporting stories in the North aren't impacted by the politics of place. Now, that's been going on. As I said, tragically, Neil Lennon is still receiving threats to this day. This year he's received two or three threats. So, you know, the Troubles may have stopped, you could argue, in 1998, but the kind of poison carries on. But McIlroy, if we're lucky, represents a kind of post-Troubles figure. It was very interesting in Britain, sitting here in Scotland, watching coverage of the US Open. Mm-hmm. And here was this Northern Irish, this young man from Northern Ireland, you know, topping the world, managing to kind of beat everyone out of sight and doing an amazingly kind of controlled and brilliant way, because he had a fantastic four rounds in the US Open this year. And yet, no one ever mentioned the Troubles through that time. Now, if 10, 15, 20 years ago, I think that would have been impossible for any commentator not to mention, you know, what was going on in Northern Ireland. Barry McGuigan, the boxer, had to fight under a white flag. He had to kind of state that he was neutral in some way. He couldn't escape in that sense. He had to actually make a statement about it, just in the way he boxed, or in the flags he flew under, or he boxed under rather. McIlroy isn't in the same position. He's in a position where he hopefully will not be impacted by the Troubles. This is the first time maybe there's a sporting story that isn't hit by the politics of place. I would love to think so anyway.
So you start with Best and end with McIlroy, these two.
It's not too bad, is it?
Yeah, two transcendent figures. As you were speaking, I was, I was thinking how appropriate that is that you have these two figures. I'll ask you to finish up. So this was your first book. Are you working on a second book?
No, I'm enjoying doing nothing. I don't know. It was a long haul. I started it, I think, in early 2009, and it went through a couple of rewrites. And the book it's quite different than the first draft. The first draft was much more. It's much more chronological now. It goes from the late 60s to now. Before, it was more sports. Each chapter was a different sport, and I kind of carried through. So it's changed quite a bit. So it was a bit of work. There was a bit of work involved, and I have a day job.
Yeah.
So there are other things that I might be interested in writing, but I'm not sure. I certainly haven't got there yet.
Well, let me ask you this about working on the book. So as you said at the start of the interview, your day job includes interviewing actors, film stars, you know, people in popular culture. So that's just part of your job. Was there a different kind of, did you have something of a thrill in getting the chance to interview sports figures that you had grown up watching?
Yeah, well, it's interesting that when I meet someone, I'm never starstruck. You know, it's my job. I have to do it, and it doesn't help if I'm starstruck. I have to say, though, when I met Jerry Armstrong scored the goal against Spain in 1982, which is my favorite sporting moment. I mean, it is the moment that I felt most alive as a sports fan. I did get a bit of a thrill. The fact that I'm sitting down opposite the guy who scored the goal that thrilled me more than almost any other goal, even though it was a pretty rubbish goal. There's nothing spectacular about it. You couldn't say it was
the goalie's mistake.
It was the goalie's mistake, and there was no great artistry to it. It wasn't very Georgie Best. There was no kind of beating 15 men and then slotting it home in some spectacular fashion. It was a very nondescript goal, but it thrilled me more than any other. And sitting down and meeting him in a cafe in Hollywood, which is just a few miles outside Belfast, was definitely a big thrill. Definitely a big thrill. And, you know, I had to kind of rein myself in and not gush at that point, I have to say. Other than that, no, I don't think, I mean, I met a lot of people I'd always admired and who were heroes, if you like, because sport does throw up heroes, doesn't it? I was reasonably able to keep myself in control, but meeting Jerry was the one moment which I think I was in danger of losing it.
All right. Well, thanks a lot, Teddy. This was I really enjoyed this book, and as I said, you know, it has the troubles in the title, but it is a book that speaks more broadly about the experience of being a sports fan, and you know, for myself, someone who grew up in the United States, far removed from you know, worrying about his father's safety when he went off to work, it's you know, it really spoke to me in terms of my experience as a sports fan. So thank you very much for being on the program.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to an interview with Teddy Jameson about his book, Whose Side Are You On? Sport, the Troubles, and Me, published in 2011 by Yellow Jersey Press. New Books in Sports is part of the New Books Network, which offers dozens of channels of podcast interviews with the authors of new publications on subjects from philosophy and religion to pop music and public policy. If you like what you heard here, please subscribe to New Books in Sports at the iTunes Store and link to our page on Facebook, where you can give us feedback, suggest new books, and find links to quality, shorter sports writing. I'm your host, Bruce Berglund. Thanks for listening, and enjoy your week.